This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. L.A. Confidential has been praised as one of the best movies of the 1990s. It picked up two Academy Awards in 1998 and was nominated for Best Picture. The author of the novel on which the movie was based is considered by some to be the best crime novelist of all time. James Ellroy has written extensively, but not strictly, about Los Angeles, the city where he was born and raised. His latest book is Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales, and James Ellroy is in North Carolina for the day, and he's here with us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Melinda. Hello, North Carolina. Hello to the planet Mars.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. I don't know what it is for interplanetary calls, but it's 1-877-962-9862. Well, James Ellroy, most people know you as a writer of books about crime. The LA Times described your writing as, and I'm quoting here, energetic and abrasive. It comes at us like a speed freak, spitting out words at a blazing cadence to make room for new ones. And I was searching for new adjectives to describe your work, but I figured nobody was perhaps better in a better position than you to describe your writing.
I write violent books about America in violent times, more specifically LA in violent times, in the language of the times. My language is tailored to my stories. Violent words, violent deeds. I love the American idiom. I love racial invective, Yiddish, slang, hipster patois. It all works. I dig alliteration.
Now, how did you describe this book, your latest, Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales, as an indulgence of your obsessions?
Yes.
Explain yourself.
When I was 13, 14 years old, I figured out that there were six or seven things that I truly dug. Crime, women, sports cars, dogs, boxing, and classical music. If I have spent 16 seconds of the past 40 years since then thinking about other things, I don't know it.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'd like to get to the dogs and classical music and sports cars in a moment, but I do want to talk about the crime and women because it is where you focus so much of your work. And you describe yourself, too, as a historical novelist. And you're specializing in an era, what, between the time you were born in the 40s and going through the 60s, would you say, Los Angeles?
Yeah, I've broken down my histories of America into two parts, my L.A. Quartet, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz, which cover Los Angeles specifically from 47 to 59, and my two most recent novels. The first two parts of the Underworld USA trilogy, American Tabloid, 58 to 63, Jack Kennedy, Rise and Fall, and all the tumult of the American 1960s, 63 to 68 specifically, in the second novel, The Cold 6000.
Mm-hmm. And in Los Angeles?
No.
No, not
the last two novels are America as a whole.
Okay. But you drew for the longest time on Los Angeles.
I was very lucky in that my parents hatched me in the film noir epicenter at the middle of the film noir era. I was born in L.A. in 48. I think that says it all. My mother was murdered in 58 when I was 10, hence my obsession with crime. Mm-hmm. How could I be anything else?
Mm-hmm. And you write about that very eloquently here in your new book about your mother's murder. And that sets you up for having this focusing on murder and murders of women in particular. And the Black Dahlia, which was the title of one of your books, but also, a real case in L.A.
Yes. My mother's death engendered in me a tremendous curiosity into all things criminal. Psychosexual behavior, police work, forensic science, the overall social fabric of first L.A. and later America as crime pervades it. Crime is not an isolated circumstance, but a continuing condition.
And you don't necessarily need to see those murders solved. That's not the point of the story.
No, there's a piece in Destination Morgue called Stephanie about the murder of a lovely young girl, 16 years old, roughly a contemporary of mine, named Stephanie Gorman. She was murdered in L.A. in the summer of 65. Cherchez la femme with me. It's all women.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, I'm a male, heterosexual, romantic, and I have a gender-wide crush on women, and my mom was a murder victim, and she was a good-looking redhead, and I was hitting puberty at the time of her death, and it's all jungled up in there. Mm-hmm. And you know what? There's no closure, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Mm-hmm. It's given you fodder all these years, no?
Oh, yeah. And it's beyond inspiration. It's exploitation in the best and most positive sense of the word.
Are you comfortable with that, with exploitation?
Yes.
Some might say obsession, but you're okay with that, too?
I'll take obsession, too.
It pays the bills.
It does.
Is that why?
No. Obsession fits neatly with me. Yes, I have some sleepless nights. But as James M. Cain once said, if your books aren't keeping you up nights, they're not going to keep anyone else up nights either.
I mean, do you have certain passages that keep you up at nights that you've written?
I think a lot. And sometimes when my head hits the pillow, the thinking becomes that much more intense. Mm-hmm. I get to sleep sooner or later.
Yeah.
Just sleep a little bit later in the day and get to work.
I just have that image of somebody who, you know, would tell ghost stories to their children to go to sleep or something. Well, that's perhaps not the way to make them go to sleep. But tell a ghost story, but then it comes back to haunt you if you're the teller of it.
That's true. Although I do tell the stories to my dog, Margaret, who hates me.
Do you think it's because you tell the stories to the dog? Maybe Margaret doesn't like your stories.
Margaret wants to dominate me. Margaret is an alpha bull terrier. Got her when she was 4 years old, and she greatly prefers women to men. Frankly, Margaret is a radical, lesbian, feminist, separatist dog.
And then we have an example of your writing, too.
That's right.
How you would put it in writing.
That's right.
James Ellroy is our guest this hour on The State of Things. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. He's author, of course, of L.A. Confidential, White Jazz, and Black Dahlia, and most recently of Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales. Black Dahlia was a book you wrote a number of years ago. There's a movie being made about that right now, isn't there? Or has
they
been
keep telling me they're going to shoot in March. It's been postponed a few times. Wouldn't floor me if it went in the tank. They have purchased the damn thing from me. That's a good indication that it's going forward. Mm-hmm. The plan is to shoot the interiors in Prague, Czechoslovakia, presumably because the labor is cheap over there.
And
the
because it resembles Los Angeles so much.
Right.
I mean, it does. And this was a murder that took place in L.A.
This is an L.A. 1947 murder. And apparently what they're doing on a soundstage in Prague is recreating a stretch of Hollywood Boulevard down to exact detail.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like they've gone some distance toward making this, no? Or no?
When the cameras roll, then I'm convinced.
Okay. Now, there's an update on that story. For years, an unsolved murder. And then a book came out a while back.
It came out by a retired LAPD detective named Steve Hodell, pinned the murder on his father. I did not find his original argument in hardcover convincing. New information came to light. I became convinced, and I wrote the foreword to the paperback edition.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're persuaded that the homicide cop's father, former homicide cop's father, author of this book,
yes,
that he was behind the murder.
Right.
And why didn't the police solve that?
Steve Hodell posits, unconvincingly, a police cover-up. I don't buy it. I think that the crime was unprovable at the time, and Pops skedaddled in the nick of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're talking with James Ellroy. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. And Dennis is with us from Hillsboro. Hi, Dennis.
Hey there.
Hey.
You know, it was interesting to hear classical music among that list of obsessions rather than jazz.
Yeah.
I would have thought jazz might have been on that list.
I dig jazz. I dig Stan Kenton, Stan Kenton's band. He was a blaster.
Yeah, and he played off the classics, too.
Mm-hmm, he did.
So
That's right.
In the classical vein, well, who do you think's the criminal element in classical music?
I think Beethoven's the king. I like the romantics. I like big, thunderous, dark, passionate music. Beethoven, Brahms, Bruckner, Schubert, Schumann, Mahler, Rachmaninoff, Chopin, Liszt.
And I might add Scriabin to that list.
I like Scriabin. Scriabin's about madness.
Yeah, that's about as close to crime as I could think of.
Yeah.
I love listening to you, and keep up the good work.
I'm writing as fast as I can, Jack. If I wasn't talking to you, I'd be writing now.
Ha!
Dennis, thanks for the call. Well, James, what is your writing discipline? Do you write every day?
Get up in the morning, smoke a little crack cocaine. Quick start my heart. Get down to it. No, I write all day, every day, sometimes into the evenings.
I mean, hours at a time?
Yes.
And then do you edit a lot from that? Because you would have compendiums at that point with that much
everything
writing.
That I write derives from profoundly detailed outlines. I know exactly where a journalistic piece, a novel, a novella, a short story of mine is going from the get-go. The superstructure is imperative if you want to write big, dense, complexly layered and structured books. Mm-hmm. I'm a formalist, and I need the outline. That stated, the outline allows me to live within the characterizations and improvise within the context of the individual scenes.
Mm. Have you always had that discipline from the get-go, when you started writing?
Yes.
And where'd you learn that?
Didn't start writing until I was 30, almost 31 years old. I was a profligate guy for many years, lived very badly, cleaned up my life when I was 29, and found out that I was a well-disciplined square in waiting.
Is that where the classical music comes in or not?
I fell in love with classical music in junior high school, circa 1961. Have never loved anything musically as much as I have loved it. Have never liked rock and roll, never saw the profundity in rock and roll. My message to rock and rollers worldwide is quit wearing black exclusively and quit rebelling against your parents.
And did you ever try to play classical music?
No. No, I do have a podium baton, though, that I wave when I listen to music at home.
Really? And how does Margaret the dog like that?
Margaret the dog is determined to get me out of the house. She follows me around, barks at me, growls at me. My days are numbered.
Okay. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. We're talking with James Ellroy, author of L.A. Confidential. His latest book, Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales, is just out, and he's appearing in the area here in North Carolina. He'll be in Durham tonight at the Regulator Bookstore, and he's talking with us about his writing and Los Angeles and his life. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. It's 1-877-962-9862. I was wondering if you might give us a short reading from the book. And we should explain that the first half of the book is based on a number of articles you wrote for GQ over the years.
That's correct. And autobiographical essays, piece on scandal rag journalism, which I'll read from, and Mexican boxing, piece on the death penalty, the Stephanie Gorman homicide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and this is what we have here is something that you've written. This concludes the piece you wrote about the rags, right?
That's right. It's called I've Got the Goods, and this is the conclusion. Here it is. I'm full of Midwestern fervor. I judge sternly. I hate Bill Clinton. I love Bill Bennett and Bill O'Reilly. I mess with notions of the Lutheran ministry. I know a pastor of some renown. He said he could get me into divinity school. They'll waive the high school diploma requirement in my case. My wife finds this calling dubious. She sees me as a man of soiled cloth. I couldn't hack divinity school. I'm too joyous and profane. I see God in foul language and sex. I'm more L.A. than Kansas City. The Lutheran Church would disdain me. They'd quash the dirty tales I write for GQ. The notion persists. The calling calls. My wife has successfully countermanded it. She's got the goods on me. She'll go to the tabs in a hot flash.
James Ellroy reading from Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales. So you really were thinking about the ministry?
No, it's a gag.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
A joke.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Huh.
Okay, so we can't take...
I dig Martin Luther. Burned the world to the ground, the world as it was known then, because it was horny, because he wanted to violate the Catholic celibate laws. And Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation are the basis of Western democracy, you know, as Newt Gingrich once said.
Mm-hmm. So, which brings me to another issue here. Just judging by, you say you hate Bill Clinton, love Bill Bennett, Bill O'Reilly, politically, right of center?
No, or, not necessarily.
How would you describe yourself?
Iconoclastic, moralistic, yeah. Now, Bill O'Reilly is an old chum of mine, I think is in trouble now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of tabloids.
Oh, Bill. I wonder what's going on there.
Would you write about it? Because, for those who don't know Bill O'Reilly, there was a woman who worked at Fox News who was accusing him of harassment.
Well, Melinda, what's the latest on it? I just heard about it yesterday.
That's all. I just haven't paid attention. Yeah. He's denying it and countersuing, I
really?
Believe.
Okay.
Countersuing.
Okay. I think O'Reilly's a good man. And the single most self-absorbed human being I've ever met, but I was the first guy to profile O'Reilly for National News Magazine. I also wrote the afterword to his second book. So I'm going to reserve judgment on this, let the truth be known. And that stated, I should say that I'm on O'Reilly's side, innocent until proven guilty.
Do you take that position a lot, innocent until proven guilty, as a crime writer? Or do you sometimes go with your gut about things? Because you can't wait for a court of law, necessarily.
No, you certainly can't. I mean, they're the obvious, you know, the lobs that are damn easy, like O.J. guilty. Come on. Yeah, that's an easy one there. Yeah. Kobe Bryant, you know, slightly more ambiguous, but I lean toward guilt. Mm-hmm. Robert Blake, I lean toward guilt. Mm-hmm. Bill O'Reilly, I've just heard it.
Right. It's too new.
It's too new.
You're right about Robert Blake, the actor, now in his 60s, I believe. He was on Beretta. He was a child actor, too, right?
He's 70. His trial has been delayed now
for the murder of his wife.
Yes, for 3.5 years. And I think he understands that he can't cop any kind of plea because it'll simply put him in prison for the rest of his life. So he may be simply delaying the inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And hoping he just lives out his years before he has to actually stand trial.
Right.
You make the case that as a celebrity, he's perhaps more able to do that than others of us?
Since the O.J. precedent, yes.
Huh. Why do you think that is? Wouldn't prosecutors be on to this by now?
The prosecution in any criminal trial has a mandate, which is prove truth at any cost. The defense has a mandate of use innocence, and assert it at any cost and by any means. So the prosecutors are enjoined to be honorable, and the defense attorneys are not. And you can split hairs, you can split hairs, you can split hairs. And what O.J. has done is take potential celebrity verdicts out of the realm of basic reason.
Mm-hmm. We go to the phones. Catherine is with us now from Greensboro. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Melinda. I just had a quick question. I wanted to know where he came up with his ideas for characters for the book. My husband and I just enjoyed a book on tape, Low Light, on our way back from Florida to North Carolina, and I just wanted to find out where he comes up with his characters.
Low Life?
Yes.
I didn't write that book.
Oh, you didn't?
That's Luke Sante.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
It's okay. But if you had written it, where would you have come up with those characters?
Yeah, in the gutter.
Catherine, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Right.
Mel's in Hillsboro. Hi there, Mel.
Hey.
Hi.
How's everything?
Okay. Did you have a comment for James Ellroy?
Yeah, I do. I was in the Regulator bookshop last week, and speaking to the owner, I noticed he was going to be there. And my band's in town tonight playing in Durham, so I'm going to make every attempt to get down there before the show, because I really think that Mr. Ellroy's, he's my favorite American writer.
God bless you, Mel.
Not crime fiction, just writing, because his style is completely identifiable once you see how he does it. And it also requires a lot of participation on the reader, cerebral, I believe. And in addition, the way he colors his stories, like you take American Tabloid, then you take the Cole 6000, just the content there, I'm intrigued with what kind of research and development went into getting all that stuff, but I can imagine it must have taken quite a long time.
I'll comment on that, Mel. What I do in the end is make it all up. Also, and I'm not being disingenuous here, American history, LA history more specifically, has been kind to me. I hire researchers for $25 an hour. They compile fact sheets and chronologies. I have a good handle on the books going in, and they provide me with details that allows me to stay within the realm of historical veracity. Now, that stated, there's a key to the art of writing historical fiction. That is, never show your established historical characters in previously established historical contexts. You don't need to see John Kennedy give his inaugural address or Martin Luther King give his I Have a Dream speech. Better to show these guys in bed with hookers sent in by the FBI and hotwired by Freddie Turrentine, bug man to the stars.
So what you're saying is you just, the rest of that we already understand. We know that we JFK know was inaugurated. We know that Martin Luther King gave a speech. Yeah. And you're just taking off from there.
Yes. I'm putting these guys, you know, down in the gutter with the lowlifes who attended their ascents and falls. Mm.
Does that just make for more of an economy? You don't have to go through that other stuff.
It's there a subtext. You don't need it. What it does is levels the playing field and puts the great down there with the low life.
Okay. Well, Mel, are you still there?
I am. I have one more question. Where did you make that stuff up about putting the shotgun shells in the mouth and taping them shut before you put them in the fire, or was that actually something you read about?
I made it up, Mel.
Boy. You really are twisted.
I'm a twisted you-know-what, Mel.
In a good way, though.
God bless you, Mel.
Mel, do you play classical music in your band?
No, we play Zydeco Swamp Rock. So it's kind of classical in a sense, but it's way out there.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
But look, we'll be at the West End Tavern on Coal Mill Road tonight, so everybody come out and have a mojo party.
Okay.
Mel. I'll see you tonight at the Regulator.
Mel, thanks so much. 1-877-962-9862. Our guest is James Elroy, author, most recently, of Destination Morgue, L.A. Tales. James Elroy, a moment ago you were talking about the idea of guilt and innocence and tending to side more with the prosecution and things. Mm-hmm. However, there was one chapter in your book, and it was initially a GQ magazine article called Grave Doubt, and this deals with the death penalty.
Yeah.
And this is a case of a guy named Gary Graham in Texas,
right,
who he was a ne'er-do-well, to put it blandly.
Right.
But he is convicted of a murder. Mm-hmm. And you say going into this that your quote here is that if you have to know why we need the death penalty, you're never going to know. Mm-hmm. You were an advocate of it.
Right.
And this case turns you around.
Right. The processes attending Gary Graham's conviction and ultimate execution were entirely skewed. I tend to think he did it. I'm 85% convinced that he killed the man that he was accused of killing. But it was a single eyewitness testimony at night, stranger eyewitness testimony. Outside of Harris County, Texas, you couldn't even file this case with the DA's office. The lawyer, Graham's lawyer, was less than spectacular and referred to his own client on the witness stand as the killer. He was 17 years old, so a juvenile by most standards, when he was convicted. And there are other doubts as well. As stated before, I tend to think he did it. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have fried him for it.
Because of that 15% doubt?
Because of the 15% doubt, because the case wasn't even fileable in jurisdictions outside of either Texas as a whole or Harris County, Texas.
Mm. And so you say, you wrote there very poignantly that your bottom line resistance dissolved there. Mm-hmm. And you said it was a proven non-deterrent.
Well,
so why did you like the death penalty in the first
because
place?
Because it sets a standard of intolerance for violent crime. And because it gives people, not closure, which is preposterous, but it gives them vengeance. And I believe in vengeance. I believe in punishment. I believe in the punitive system of penology rather than the rehabilitative. I think prisons should be austere places where prisoners should be free from potential sexual abuse and potential violence, but should live austere lives where hopefully they would become penitent.
So where would you stand if do you take a position publicly? Are you out to try to repeal the death penalty? You try to reform the way it's...
I'm adding to the overall dialogue on the issue. And death penalty, my resistance to it is three-pronged. It's a proven non-deterrent. It's never proven to be a deterrent. Recent DNA advent has exonerated 140 men off death row, convicted on DNA evidence, the absence of DNA evidence, DNA exoneration, bam, they're gone. It's 140 guys who would have been fried had DNA not become exploitable. Hmm. And thirdly, it's more expensive to put a person through death row appeals than it is to keep them in prison the rest of their lives.
So do we keep the system? Do we keep that there?
I personally, I wouldn't fry anybody. I like George Ryan, oddly a conservative Republican, the Illinois governor who suspended application of the death penalty. If there were checks and balances that could make the system foolproof, I'd be all for it. But since there's 50 states here, that's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. Ergo, I think we should repeal the death penalty.
We go to Barbara in Raleigh. Hi there, Barbara.
Hey.
Hi. Did you have a question for James Elroy?
I did. I saw a survey, or John F. Kennedy was named the healthiest president in American history, and Bill Clinton was number two. And I immediately thought of Mr. Elroy and referring to him as Bad Back Jack, which is what I can't help but think of him.
Or Barbara, two-minute Jack.
I'm sorry?
Two-minute Jack.
Two-minute Jack, yes. Right. And I was wondering if you had seen that and if you thought that was interesting or if you'd seen anything.
They were
like
described
that.
As the healthiest?
Healthiest presidents in American history.
In Jack terms of?
Physical health?
All overall physical health, yeah.
Jack was in tremendously frail health.
That's what I had thought.
Yeah. He could almost be described as dying. He had Addison's disease. He was on numerous medications.
Mm-hmm.
He had stratospheric cholesterol. I wouldn't call him a healthy guy. Mentally, certainly much healthier than Bill Clinton.
Well, Barbara, does that answer your question?
Right. Yes, thank you so much.
Okay. Hey, Barbs.
Yes.
Bad Back Jack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, Barbs.
Thanks, Barbara. 1-877-962-9862. I read someplace that you were interested in writing about another era and much more removed from the decades that you've covered
sooner,
so far.
Sooner or later, I'm going to write a novel about Warren Harding's administration.
Now, why Warren Harding?
Second most corrupt administration in American history. Wonderful scandal, Teapot Dome, the specter of his possible murder by his wife, Florence Kling Harding. Wonderful characters like Harry Doherty, the Attorney General, and his male companion, Jess Smith, selling booze, patent liquor, during Prohibition out of the Attorney General's office. What a story. Allegedly, Harry Doherty met Warren Harding in 1900. They were at a whorehouse together in Marion, Ohio. And Harry Doherty took one look at the handsome Harding and said, "Man, this guy looks like the president of the United States." And damned if the Ohio gang didn't make him the prez.
Hmm. Kingmakers.
Yes. Yeah. I could do America in the 20s then.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you working on that now?
No.
No.
I'm working on the sequel to The Cold 6000. No. Okay. Third volume in my Underworld USA trilogy.
Okay. Now, a historical novelist, you've also said somewhere that you wouldn't write about the current administration, that you need almost the distance of a couple, three decades to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I want perspective. Also, you can't write fictionally about living characters. It's illegal. They'll sue you.
Mm.
You have to wait for the people in power, the current gang, whoever they are, to die.
You couldn't just, and there's no way you could just kind of mask them, veil them slightly.
Wouldn't do it. You have to use real names.
Yeah.
You simply cannot have the verisimilitude without using the real names.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the current administration in its election season?
I do not weigh in on current issues. It's a strict policy I have. I don't want people defining me by these things. And frankly, it has nothing to do with me, the current administration, what's happening in the world today. Absolutely nothing to do with me. I am isolating my curiosity and my intellect in the years 1968 to 1972.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a bit about tabloids that played into L.A. Confidential, of course. The people, and you wrote that there was an era when you were growing up. It was the stuff that you read as a kid. It was the Bible and the Tatler tabloids.
Well, not the tabloids. The scandal mags, Transom, Hush Hush, Confidential, Whisper, Lowdown, Rave. Basic stuff that to this day I'm tremendously interested in.
Right. But then, so there was this era when that kind of thing, you could buy that. And then you say it kind of fell away?
It did fall away.
And it was the 60s and the 70s. A couple of things.
Right.
In the
60s. Well, there was a sexual revolution. They didn't have to get their titillation secondhand like that.
Mm-hmm.
That killed it off. Litigation killed it off. For a while there, the scandal rags were inviolate because, simply put, everything in them was true and factually verified.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who sued was risking even greater exposure.
Right, right. And then the 80s came along, and that's when you say you noticed that we started having a similar version.
Well, the supermarket tabloids came in. But you know, they were better-hearted. There's the chocolate diet, lose weight on an all-chocolate diet. I mean, how good can it get? Mm-hmm. You know, glimpses of God, you know, in Moose Fart, Montana. There was a sweetness to the tabloids that the scandal rags never had.
And now, arguably, some of the material, I mean, our mores have probably changed, but some of the material that might have made it into those rags back in the 50s, they would be on the TV shows at night now.
Right, yeah. Reality TV shows and participation TV shows where freaks from around the country get together, have at each other. I know that this stuff exists. I don't watch it.
Do you watch much TV?
No.
Any? What do you watch?
I watch boxing on TV. That's it, because that's one of my obsessions from 40 years ago that I keep up with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And these days, you're not living in L.A. anymore. You moved away from there almost more than 2 decades ago.
Monterey Peninsula in California, yeah.
Is there much grit to write about in Monterey?
No, thank God. It's quiet. It's peaceful. It's homogenous. I love it.
Okay. James Elroy, thanks for being with us.
Hey, a pleasure.
This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pancava. North Carolina concert pianist Greg McCallum has a new CD out. It's called Southern Quilt. And this is a compilation of 19th and 20th century classical piano pieces, all written by Southern composers or inspired by Southern culture. In fact, Greg McCallum wrote one of these himself. The album and the pieces are patchworks of familiar Southern hymns, melodies, and sounds. Three of the works are composed by North Carolinians, including, as we say, Greg McCallum. And we welcome Greg McCallum to our studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us today. Our number, if you care to talk with Greg, our number is 1-877-962-9862. The name of the CD is Southern Quilt, and this describes the way you conceived of this collection.
Right. Yeah, there's several connections. First, the piece that I wrote is called Hymn Quilt, and then all the pieces are based on different pieces of fabrics from folk music that have Southern roots in it. So it's all kind of put together as a large quilt of Southern life. And then within each piece, there are all these different tunes, you know, that form the fabric of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, would folk type music be music that you are normally working in as a concert pianist? Or you tend more toward a different type of classical music? Of course, folk music has informed some classical music.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with folk music. I think one of my heroes is Bartok, Béla Bartok. And he, of course, went out and collected, you know, folk music in Eastern Europe. And so I have always been fascinated with folk music in this country, you know, popular music, blues and jazz, and how it's influenced American composers, because it is our unique voice that, you know, grew up in this country.
Mm-hmm. So how did this particular CD come about? When did you decide that you're going to, well, we should patch all these different things together and call it a quilt?
Well, the final name actually came at the last minute. I had first performed this program back in late 90s. I had a friend, associate Carla Hodges, who gave me a recording of the Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues. She had been associated with Paul Jacobs, the pianist who commissioned the piece. And I told her I was looking for some more American music that was based on folk music. And she says, oh, you have to listen to this. So I went home and listened to it. And I was just dumbfounded by the effect of this piece. And I live here in Carrboro, North Carolina, which is a former mill town. And so I walked into the Carmel Mall, and there's this big sign that says, if these buildings could speak, on the wall. And it talked about the history of the mill and the life in the town. And I just became obsessed with the whole era. I read books about the history of the South and the Industrial Revolution in the South, like a family, and watched documentaries on TV, even interviewed mill workers here in Carrboro and other places. And then all different pieces of my life started coming together for this CD. I had heard the Blue Ridge Airs piece by Kenneth Frazelle premiered when I was a student at Eastman in Rochester, New York. And then I'd always known of Gottschalk. I'd loved his music with its Southern influence. And then there's a local composer in Carrboro, Julie Harris, who I'd worked with, and she started writing some pieces based on folk tunes. And then another flutist I worked with from New Zealand had recorded all of William Grant Still's music for flute and piano. And so she said, oh, you have to learn Summerland. And then finally, as an own tribute to my own upbringing, I wanted to write a piece about hymns. I wanted something with hymns in it that would be accessible but yet unique and creative in the treatment of the hymns. And because I grew up, you know, in a small town in Robeson County, North Carolina, Roland, and I first heard music, my mother playing hymns on the piano, and I went to a Presbyterian church, and our organist there was kind of like a hero of mine, hearing her play hymns and anything on the piano. And then my grandmother played a pump organ in a Country Baptist church. So it's a, you know, if you're a Southerner, you grow up going to church and you hear this music and it becomes a staple of your, you know, your faith and your listening enjoyment.
What do you remember most when you were going to church? I mean, is there a particular tune that stood out to you?
Probably one of the first one, two of the ones that are in the hymn quilt, Amazing Grace, which everybody knows, and then one of my favorites was an old shape note hymn, How Firm a Foundation.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear a little bit of this? And this is the piece that you composed and
right.
where you worked all these in. Let's hear this. We're going to hear, I guess, two versions of Amazing Grace here, aren't we?
Yes.
So that's the music, Amazing Grace, of course, and Greg McCallum from his piece, which is called Hymn Quilt, from his CD, Southern Quilt. We should explain that this is an 11-minute long piece.
Right.
Hymn Quilt. And so you're trying to work in all these different religious influences here in the South, in North Carolina. You started out with the more staid Presbyterian church version, then you went to the gospel.
The piece is it's a quilt of different ways people play and sing hymns, and it's kind of like a celebration of diversity. I think so often we get stuck in our own way and we think it's the right way and the only way. And here it's kind of putting everything together, say we're all saying the same thing in different languages. And in the hymn quilt, like, begins with an old shape note hymn, How Firm a Foundation, then goes into Amazing Grace. And the first verse was kind of how we sang at the Presbyterian church, which we just sang everything straight out of the hymnal. It was kind of, you know, boring to some people. And then the second verse gets a little more interesting, and it's my mother's Baptist church, and the pianist always had this sort of waltzy touch to it. And then from there it goes on to a Church of God and Pentecostal Holiness, where it sort of goes off all over the piano.
Mm-hmm.
The piece has African-American gospel influences into it, actual transcription of a song I did in a church with a gospel choir here, United Church Chapel Hill, a transcription of that. And then it gets, the spirit builds and the fervor builds, and I tried to create an avant-garde representation of speaking in tongues with clusters all over the keyboard that I actually got from an avant-garde performance I did in New York last year. And then the climax, the piece ends with the entrance of the Lutherans. We were talking about the Lutherans earlier.
James Elroy was, yes. Perhaps in a different
context.
Lutherans,
they get, you know, deemed as very staid and reserved. And so they come in and with a mighty fortress to sort of restore order to this chaos that has gone on, according to them. And then with a mighty fortress, I split every phrase up and weave in a different style from spirituals to old time religion. And then the piece kind of ends with a benediction of Shall We Gather at the River.
Well, why don't we hear some of that now? This is also from Greg McCallum's CD, A Southern Quilt. There we have from Greg McCallum's Southern Quilt. That's Hymn Quilt. Sounds like you had fun playing that. I mean, just
it's a blast to play it, and there, I have a sense of humor with it. You know, I think it's kind of funny. I think we take ourselves all times too seriously, and this is kind of weaving it all together with a sense of fun. You know, usually when I perform this in concert, when, you know, Mighty Fortress comes in, you can hear people sort of laughing. But then after the concert, people come up to you and tell you, you know, I was the Lutheran, or I was the Episcopal, or I did this. And, you know, people see a part of themselves in it, which is what I like about it.
Right. And we should just explain that when you recorded this at a church in Chapel Hill, United Church of Chapel Hill. 200 people from 27 different congregations were there.
Yeah, I put the word out. This was recorded a year ago in the summer. And I put the word out to local church bulletins and people that heard the piece. And we had 200 people show up and to do the humming, because the piece is mostly piano, but you heard the excerpts that involved audience participation, the humming and singing Amazing Grace, and then the clapping. And it was quite an interesting experience getting 200 people to clap on beats 2 and 4 in the gospel. We had it. It was fun. Everybody really enjoyed it.
How many takes did you do?
I won't tell you how many. But when it was all done, everybody cheered and said hallelujah for that, you know. But it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's move on to, we have another selection here. And this is the banjo. Mm-hmm. That we're going to hear. And this is imitating the music of minstrel performers, African-American minstrel performers?
That's correct. Yeah, Gottschalk grew up in New Orleans. And as a child in the mid-1800s, he was exposed to the music of African-American culture through dances at Congo Square and then the minstrel shows, which imitated the antics and the dance and the music of African-Americans.
So these would be whites who were imitating.
Right. Okay. And so the banjo was one of Gottschalk's first pieces that really made him famous when he went to Europe. But he's imitating the virtuoso picking of a banjo player. And in this selection that you'll hear, it's the end of it where the banjo player kind of goes crazy and just goes really fast. And he sort of is quoting Stephen Foster's song, Camp Town Races. You'll hear the harmony of Camp Town Races in that.
Okay, here we go. The banjo is heard on the piano. Is that right? Somehow it's almost, it's not twangy like you'd hear it on a banjo. Well, maybe you get a little bit of that twang on the piano.
Yeah, depends on the piano. That was an awfully beautiful piano in New York.
Really?
The Academy of Arts and Letters, yeah.
Huh. So you recorded this in a lot of different places.
Then. Yeah, most of it was recorded in New York at the Academy of Arts and Letters, but I recorded the hymn quilt in the church, and then the Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues I recorded in the abandoned, well, now it's become a business center, the Chatham Label Mill in Pittsburgh, because I had the opportunity of playing that piece there once for an art show that had to deal with textiles. It was called Loom 2, and installations that were made from relating to the mill. And I took my piano there to be part of that exhibition. And the performance of it, the acoustic was unbelievable. I'd never heard that piece sound like that in the huge abandoned space of a mill. And the piece, the beginning, the pianist, you play with your palms and elbows on white and black keys down low, alternating, and it makes the sound of looms. And to have it in that acoustic, it just multiplied the effect, so it sounded like a room full of looms weaving. It's really phenomenal.
Well, why don't we hear some of this? Okay. This is the Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues as performed by Greg McCallum. It's very percussive there. It does sound like the looms.
Yeah.
There'll be textile at the end of the day, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, there again, it's a long piece that begins with about, you know, 4 minutes of this monotonous trying to recreate the effect of working in a mill for 12 hours a day with this sound, deafening sound. And then the composer goes on and transforms that rhythm into a boogie-woogie kind of a bass, and it actually quotes a labor song from Winsboro, South Carolina, the Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing transformation of drudgery and hard work into joy by the end of the piece with the blues.
So you grew up in Robeson County.
Yes.
Near Lumberton. In
right.
Roland, you say?
Roland,
now,
yes.
When did you start playing piano?
I started in the fifth grade. My sister had had 3 years of lessons, and she was tired of it and wanted to quit. And I remember the fourth grade, I just got fascinated with it and wanted to start, you know, piano then. And so my parents said, well, you could start next year. And I always laugh. My first piano lesson was in a janitor's closet in a school in Dillon, South Carolina. They didn't have a place to put the piano for lessons that was quiet and isolated. So they had this huge walk-in closet. So they put this piano against the wall and went for lessons in this big room with toilet paper on the walls and everything. So it's a very humble beginning. But I just fell in love with the piano and practiced.
So did you have to go across state lines to take piano lessons?
Well, my teacher taught. I grew up, Roland's right on the border. I went to school there. Then she lived right down the street from me, Grace Watson in Roland. And so I continued lessons at her house just down the road.
Mm-hmm. You know. And so what were you drawn to? Was it the classical music that when you first started playing, or was it the music that you heard on the radio at that time, or some of this more folk stuff that you're?
I was first drawn to music through the church. You know, before I got in, was into music, I had briefly wanted to be a minister, and I had always sung in children's choirs, and we sang really great music in our hometown. I remember our organist. I mean, she played the Chopin C minor prelude on the organ. That's the first place I ever heard it. You know, bum bum bum, blaring on this, you know, Allen electronic organ, this small Presbyterian church. But you know, their era was, there was a lot of appreciation for classical music, and my teacher was a fabulous teacher. And so once I started taking lessons, and I think it was when I was probably about 14 that I saw the Atlanta Symphony perform in Lumberton for our community concert series, and Eugene Solomon performed the Emperor Concerto with him, and I was like, now that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of culture in the county when I was growing up.
And Carnegie Hall will be on your resume?
Yes, I'm playing in Weill Recital Hall. I have my Carnegie debut on March 17th, 2005.
What are you going to be playing there?
I'm sort of expanding the hymn quilt idea, and I'm calling it World Quilt. And it'll be music by Scarlatti, Chopin, Grieg, Debussy, then some Mettner, Nikolai Mettner, Bartok, Hinestera, Gottschalk, and then I'll end with the William Grant Still and the Cotton Mill Blues from the CD. So it's kind of a bigger perspective of sort of world classical music inspired by folk culture from around the world.
Well, and that's happening in March, is that right?
Yes, March 17th, 8 p.m.
Well, best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Best of luck. We'll be following you.
Thanks so much.
And thanks so much for coming in today to talk about A Southern Quilt.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay. Greg McCallum, the pianist behind A Southern Quilt, a CD that has been inspired by Southern composers and the South and folk music of the South. And that's the state of things for today. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have a comment about our show, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Let's hear a little bit more from A Southern Quilt by Greg McCallum. I'm Melinda Pencava.